Well, getting back to my democracy in action. You see this fellow here? You see, he had some rights, our founding fathers then, unalienable rights. In the original, I like the original text of the Declaration of Independence a little better than the final text, where originally it said, a right to life, liberty, and property. You see, look, what this man earned is property. Now, if his property can be taken away by somebody else at the other person's wish, he is the other person's slave. And the other person is his master. Oh, I know I was getting to with the feet under the table bit. And that was this. That as a child, when you're living off of someone else, that other person is your master and you'll have a servant relationship. Or with a family, it's a closer deal than that. But it basically is that you are an immature child and have to obey, don't you? Authority. If you want to be mature and to be... You have to pay your own way. A person never grows up and becomes mature until he supports himself. That's what's wrong with so many of our college students. They've never earned a dollar. They've never faced a bill. They got all the solutions at the age of 18 for all the problems of the world, and they haven't yet turned the first buck. And I'll tell you, after they get knocking around a little bit, their solutions kind of get worn down. What does democracy create? And the idea that the government is to solve your needs, to provide your food, your clothing, and everything else, that it will solve your needs, and all you need to do is vote for them, not work for them. Now, when you're living off of other people, you must be the slave of who's feeding you. Let's take a look at the feudal system. The feudal lord lived up on the hill. He owned all property. The vassal, the serf, couldn't own any property. He couldn't acquire property, enjoy property, or dispose of property. He had to live where he was told. He had to do as he was told, produce according to his ability, and consume according to his need, as the master decided the need. He was given security. He was taken care of from the cradle to the grave, wasn't he, by the master. But not liberty. Let's take a look at a Negro slave in the old plantation. He couldn't buy property. He couldn't hold property. He couldn't dispose of property. He had to live where he was told. He was produced according to his ability and was given to according to his need. He was given security. He was taken care of from the cradle to the grave, but he wasn't free. Let's take a look at the slave in a Chinese communal farm. He can't acquire property, hold property, or dispose of property. He can't move where he wishes to. He produces according to his ability. He's given to according to his need. He is given security from the cradle to the grave. You see, anyone who's living off their government or living off of somebody else must be that other person's slave. Our founding father said, if you are going to be free, you must be mature. If you are mature, you must live off your own efforts and not off another's. Any man who goes out, and you take a look at the Negro population today, are told to go out and become slaves by demanding other people to feed them. That is the road to slavery. You cannot be fed by another and be free of that other. It is nothing but the new plantation that we're being offered, only now for everybody. Of course, that may make you feel good that everybody else is in the same boat. But really, I'm not interested in being the best informed person in the concentration camp. That isn't my real goal and desire here. So let's take a look at democracy and republic and kind of wrap this up. And I promised Gary Allen I'd go through my little Rome bit. Rome, how would come with that coffee if I stall long enough? Coffee coming... Is the coffee coming, Gary? Okay, I'll wrap this up and we'll get a little coffee. The Romans somehow came up with a republic, a limited government. I don't know how they came up with it, but they did come up with it. They understood the nature of man. Man would like to rule other men. And if man can make money out of ruling, the evil men will enter it. So what they did, they put 12 immutable laws in stone. And these laws had some things like senators couldn't get paid, and they weren't elected. In fact, senators couldn't even wear the gentleman's clothes. They had to meet on a dirt floor on a small stool barefoot as they debated the affairs of state. They even went further than this, that no general could escape command of his army more than 1 year. Every year he had to come back to the Senate and put a sword before the Senate. He couldn't come back with his army. He had to come back alone. No army was allowed into Rome. We weren't going to have any men in Ohio. And he had to become a civilian for 1 year. Take a seat in the Senate, and at the end of the year, he could ask for a sword back and go back to his army. Somebody else went and took his army the year in between. This kind of kept things from getting out of hand. Anyway, they had a lot of little brilliant ideas like that, see? They had another little one. During times of national crises, they would appoint a dictator because their government was not strong enough to meet national crises. But this dictator could not mount a horse or wear a gentleman's clothes or live in a house. He had to be despised by everybody and looked down upon with loathsome creature, but obeyed. The reason, they wanted to make the job so detestable that nobody wanted it. And it would be happy to give it up as soon as the crisis was over. Pretty sharp people, huh? There's a problem with the Republic. You see, the people of Rome could keep what they produced. The government couldn't take it away from them. And any society that has ever allowed the citizens, or I shouldn't say allowed, because no government has ever allowed the citizens to keep what they produced, citizens have either created a society where the government can't take away what they produce, or the government does. Where the citizens did not allow their government to take away their produce, create the problem. That is, the society becomes vastly wealthy rapidly. In fact, so wealthy that everybody in the world wanted to be conquered by Rome. Roman armies were successful not because of their military prowess, but because the vassals, the serfs in their neighboring nations wanted to lose. Oh, the nobles didn't, but the serfs did. After all, they were living in caves, and Romans had apartment buildings and aqueducts and had everything. And here they're living gravel in the cave, and along come the Romans. Man, that's great stuff. Roman armies, why did a little city conquer the world? The world wanted to be conquered by Rome. They wanted what Rome had. That's why Rome was successful, when you want to really get down to the nitty-gritty of it. I hate that word. I use it. Mainly because of a guy I know who uses it. So here, everything is going along great. Rome was vastly wealthy, as always noticed in our nation, between 1870 and 1930. Our total national true product doubled every 8 years. Went up 4 times in 16. Went up 8 times in 24. 16 times in 32. 32 times in 40 years. In 48 years, it went up 64 times. It did this for 60 straight years. No nation in modern recorded history has ever seen anything like it. Why? People could keep what they earned. Very rare in the history of mankind have citizens been able to keep what they earned for a large share of it. You see, what this man earns is private property. Either he can keep it or it can be taken away by the will of another. If it's taken away by the will of another, he is not free. There are two ways, you see, for me to steal this man's goods. One, I put a mask on. I say, stick him up. Now, there isn't a society, including the common society, who wouldn't put me in jail for doing that. That's called stealing. But if I vote for this fella, who promises to take it away by force from you and give it to me, I'm now a Democrat. The result is the same, except now I'm stealing legally, and I'm no longer a criminal, but an honorable citizen. If I can get enough people to steal with me, we form a democracy. And now we can steal absolutely immune to all laws. In fact, we make all laws to make the stealing not only legal, but moral. That's called democracy in action. Democracy is only the process where the biggest thieves can get elected, because only the person who promises to steal the most can win. Any promise to steal less isn't going to make it. Well, let's get back to Rome. Things were going along real great for a few hundred years in Rome. Rome was becoming very wealthy and powerful. The senator said, look, if it's not right, you see, some of the senators are poor, living in hovels, and here, wealthy, wealthy Rome. Rome can afford to put their government in the conditions and standards like governments of other nations. It's terrible to have the Roman Senate living in such conditions. We should have some nice buildings, you know, for dignity of the state, for the good of the people. Of course, you understand, always for the good of the people. Some people said, don't you see those laws? You can't do that. Remember Animal Farm? Those of you who read Animal Farm, they painted on the end of the barn when the animals threw out the man, they were run the farm themselves, and they put all the laws on our no animals sleep in bed, no animals will live in houses, and all the other things, you know, and all. And finally, the great rule of the end was all animals are equal. And finally, the pigs, you know, moved in the houses. They're sleeping in the beds. The pigs are taking over everything. And one day, the other animals starving, freezing out there, look at the end of the barn and says, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. Well, anyway, I said the senator ought to be paid. They should have some dignity. And people said, oh, no, the immutable laws. They said, well, who made those laws? Why, man made those laws. If man made them, man can change them. And if man made them, then man's government, man rule, democracy, should decide whether they can be changed or not. We should let the people decide. Well, I guess man did make the laws. No, man didn't make the laws. The laws, if they're right, they're right because they're right, regardless of who made them. If they're wrong, they're wrong, regardless of who made them or how they were made. Principle doesn't change because of majority whim. Truth is truth, regardless of how many people believe in it. Now, I'll tell you something. When you find yourself on the side of the majority, get out. You're wrong. Anytime you find yourself on the side of the majority, check your premises. I'll tell you, the day most people in the world become Christian, I'm going to check it over. I don't think I have a real worry. But, man, I got to get a couple of the sides out. They're getting me off my track today. I have been so disorganized. Well, we're back in Rome again. So the Senate had their election. They're going to decide these things. Before they had the election, the Senate, very kindly and loving the citizens of Rome, gave them 300,000 welfare checks. You know the Senate won? People agreed the Senate was quite nice. But then people found out something. Their taxes went up more than the welfare check. That's not so good. See, only taxpayers were voting. Taxpayers weren't going to support the next round, were they? So they came up with a new game, saying, and look, servants, after all, are people. They live in our homes. They're practically members of the family. Most of them have been with us for generations. They should vote. Why? Servants didn't pay taxes, you see, and there were more of them. They could outvote the taxpayers. How can you steal? Taxpayers keep doing all the voting. Remember in our country, when it was founded, only white male property owners could vote. That was undemocratic, wasn't it? Why did our founding fathers only allow white male property owners to vote? Because only white male property owners paid taxes. Notice, taxpayers don't vote for crooks. Non-taxpayers vote for crooks. Taxpayers won't vote for crooks. The idea was no taxation without representation, and no representation without taxation. If you don't put your money in the pot, you keep your mouth shut. I mean, even those of you people who play poker know that. You don't draw cards unless you got your ante in. Right? You see, when you have the people who don't pay taxes vote, they vote for stealing. Taxpayers don't vote for crooks. Non-taxpayers do. So then servants, you see, yes, they should vote. So they started voting, but the servants found out their masters were going broke. Because now the total welfare program got bigger and bigger, and the servants things were getting worse around the house. They lived there too. And so they started siding with their masters. That's not so good. The senators came up to them and they said, look, the slaves. They're people, too. They should vote. They didn't pay taxes, you see. But you turn... Then they enfranchise the slaves. Then they enfranchise the people in the colonies. And they enfranchise everybody in the empire eventually. And what happened? The number of people to pay before every election time became bigger and bigger and bigger. The second is these people wanted more than they got last time. Every year it had to go up. The take had to go up. See, you had more people to pay. I got the coffee signal. Then we got more people to pay. And we got to pay them more each time. The tax rate must go up even faster, mustn't it? Every time there's an increase in taxes, some of the businessmen, the farmers, who were just making it before, now went under, couldn't pay the taxes. When they couldn't pay the taxes, the state seized their business, seized their farm for payment of taxes. This meant that you had more people on the take, because these people went down the road and joined the mob, put their hand out for the government to feed them, didn't they? And that meant less people, more people to feed and less people to tax. So the tax rates even had to go up higher. In a short period of time, Rome, the taxes went to 110% of net worth annually. That means direct confiscation of all private property. Now, what now? You had the big mob in the street, all demanding. After all, isn't it the government's job to feed us, to clothe us, and take care of us? It's the government's job. After all, you've told us this. You've told us that you're going to take care of everything. But the government found out something. With nobody growing and nobody producing, there wasn't anything to feed the people with. And they said, don't you know how much we love you? Haven't we given you all of this free? Don't you love us? And they said, we want your blood or we want bread. Well, oh, you can't demand our blood. We've taken care of you. We love you. But the mob didn't think much about love. They were hungry. They wanted to eat. And what did the Senate have to do? They had to call in the legion to put down the mob. And the legion marched in beautiful array. In a very short period of time, Scala had put down the mob. And they said, thank you, Consul. That's their name for general. Thank you, Consul, for saving Rome. Very patriotic of you. We want to commend you. And the general said, you know, fellas, I think you got the name wrong. It's Emperor. Now, you boys can play the little Senate game. You run your little election play. And you have all your little fun up there. But don't do anything unless I tell you it's okay. Or... There's never been a democracy that hasn't ended up in a police state. And unless the democracy is eliminated by its reversal, it will end up in a total dictatorial police state with total economic collapse. It is inevitable. Plato told you this 3,000 years ago. The Romans proved it 2,000 years ago. England has proven it. We're proving it at a very rapid rate. Democracy always ends up in robbery of one citizen to the other. The citizens doing the robbery eventually rob the citizens they're robbing out, and then they cannot survive, and collapse and chaos is inevitable. The police state is the only solution to the problem. Martial law of the bayonet. You cannot solve problems by democracy, but by its absence. Notice in England today, taxation of people earning, let me get my figure straight, more than $60,000 a year is in excess of 100% of earnings. Don't worry, there were only five people in England last year earned $35,000. In England today, the average age of the machinery is 47 years old. In England today, over 50% of the population live totally off a government check. This means that every man must feed another who isn't working with machinery 47 years old. England is all through. It is in total collapse. And there is no monetary revaluing that can save it. For it has socialism. And socialism is the disease, the cancer that erodes any society. We're going to have to take a coffee break. Thank you. My friend here, who is going to be the number... Look at what a glutton for punishment. He came right back. I wanted to stand up and take a little bow. You see, our founding fathers looked at it this way. They said, look, what kind of rights should a man have? I'm going to do something that is not tolerated in liberal circles, and that is, I'm going to define justice. I'm old-fashioned, you see. I believe there is a thing called truth, and I think there's a thing called lie. I believe there's a thing called right, and there's a thing called wrong. There's moral and immoral. There's just and unjust. And I think they can be accurately and precisely defined. One of the games we get in schools today is a game like this, and I had this for my philosophy professor. Watch this sort of thinking, and you wonder why we're in the trouble we're in. You see, this thing here is called a table. Now, it isn't really a table. We only put the name table on it. It's a thing we say has tableness. Now, you see, though it has the ability to serve as a table, we're not really even sure whether it is a table, or we're not really sure whether that table is even there. Why are we not sure whether that table is there or not? Because we can't prove whether we're here or not. And if we can't prove whether we're here or not, how do we know whether that table is there or not? Now, we can run into that table, we can bite on it, we can sit on it, but still we are not certain of the existence of the table, no more than we're certain of the existence of anything, including truth. Therefore, it is impossible to even conceive of anything being really right or wrong, good or evil, that all things are relative. That is, everything is in kind of a gray melange, to where none of us can really decide our own actions with any precision. It just depends what is in our heart right now that makes things moral or immoral. Notice our new morality. A new morality goes something like this. You see, if I would injure this man out of hatred for him, that would be immoral. But if I did it for the good of mankind, that would be moral. It isn't the act that I do that is moral or immoral. It's why I do it. If I am doing honestly what is in my heart, then it's moral. Boy, isn't that a great license for anything? Huh? This isn't morality or immorality. It's the absence of morality. It's amorality. There is no morality. It is the denial of even a moral concept, of even can exist. You want to know why the suicide rate is 400% among college students of the general population? What else? There is no divine, there is no purpose, there is no nothing. It's just you can get here in this world and it's all dirty and evil. And what can you do? Put a rope around your head like the four students at Indiana University in one semester tied it to the girder in the field house and took a leap off the 33rd pier. What else? They are told that there's nothing you can believe, there's nothing you can know, there's no right or wrong, there's no true or false, there are no answers to anything. And they call that an education. That's a brain laundry. Let's get the name right for it. See, I'm kind of not very bright. I guess I went to college for 11 years. I survived. That's because I don't believe anything I was taught. The problem with the average youth is the real problem, and this is the thing. I had at University of Detroit, while I was teaching one time, my whole class went in to complain to the dean. The whole class marched up. And you know what their complaint was? The dean came down and he said, "You won't believe it. You won't believe what the complaint was." You know what the complaint of the students were? Dr. Crane required them to think. I wouldn't accept the answers that they had memorized in the book. And it was unfair. I required them to reason their answers. Thinking is not tolerated. An educated man is a man who has learned to discern, who has learned to challenge, to criticize, and to analyze, not want to absorb and feed back. That's what a tape recorder does. You buy them for $100, and they're much more reliable. You can't beat the tape recorder. That's why I say don't take notes. Tape recorder is much more efficient. You know, the professor who was... professors nowadays spend very little time on campus. He's always off with some government agency somewhere or other. And this one professor, he put all of his lectures on tape, and he had a student assistant go in, every time the class and turn on a tape recorder and put on the right tape. And one day, quite late in the semester, he inadvertently, for some reason, found himself on campus. And he decided to go over and find out how his class was doing,
just for curiosity, and you looked in there, and there was this tape recorder playing real well, and 35 other tape recorders on record. Well, that's the way most students go to school anyway. You know, it's heartwarming when you ever find a student. I call the rest of them enrollees. They pay my wages, you know. You don't knock them because, you know, I just tell them, you know, just sit there and just keep paying the tuition. Well, I forget, here in California, you've got total thinkism. You have reached the epitome of folly. Well, one thing about California, whenever they're going to do anything, they can do it worse than anyone. They don't believe in halfway measures. I like to see that. Anyway, I started out on something there. Well, I was going to tell you what justice and injustice, I was going to define it precisely. How do you like that? Boy, that'd get me fired from most universities. Well, the height of ignorance to think that you can define to anything. You know what justice and injustice is? You see, this man here has a right to defend his life by force if necessary, if I should try to take it. And he has a right, a divine right, to protect his liberty and his property if I should try to take it by force. I have the same right. This is the whole basis of our Constitution. She and I have that right, and he has that right. Therefore, we don't have the right. I don't have the right to take his life, his liberty, or his property, nor has he got the right to take my life, my liberty, and my property. These are not rights created by government. They're not civil. They're unalienable. They were belong to man before government. These are what are meant by unalienable rights. They are, some people, those who don't want to deny the divine, want to call them natural rights. Others want to call them God-given rights. But either way, they weren't given by government. All people agree on one thing. They are not government created. They are not civil. And cannot be. Now, seeing he has a right to defend his life, liberty, and property, I do too. Therefore, collectively, we have a right to form an association to protect collectively our lives, liberty, and property. But seeing we only have the right to protect our lives, liberty, and property, and do not have the right to take another's life, liberty, or property, we have no power, justly, to give to the government the power to do what we don't have the power to do. How can I justly give to the government the power to take away his life, liberty, and property when I don't have that right in the first place? When a government does what we wouldn't let people do, it's unjust. It's legal because they are the government, but it's not just. Justice is when the government is limited to doing only those things we would tolerate people doing. If I can do through government that which I could not do of myself, those acts are unjust and immoral. That's a very precise definition, isn't it? All you have to do to apply to any law is say, would we let a man do that? Would we let a man go and take another person's property by force for his own use without his volunteering? Therefore, do you have a right to give to the government the power to do that very thing? Does the government have the right to do that very thing? No. You see, stealing is wrong regardless of how many people you get to steal with you. Merely getting a majority of thieves together doesn't make stealing moral. And that's what we're told today, isn't it? If a majority wants to steal, then nothing's wrong with stealing. I believe stealing's wrong regardless of how many crooks I find to join with me. And that's the whole rub, isn't it? The demagogues know that once you get a stealing people and you promote to give them something for nothing, they can't have something for nothing. Somebody's got to earn everything. You see, everything you live off of, everyone in this room, everything you're going to consume in your lifetime, somebody had to earn. Either you earned it, or somebody else earned it, and you took it away from them. And there's two ways to take away what another man earns. You can steal it illegally, or legally with a ballot. But you got to steal it. You're either going to live off the fruits of your own labor, or off the fruits of another's labor.
And if you give the government the power to allow you to live off the fruits of another's labor, you're going to be enslaved by that very government, along with the man you're stealing from. There is no other course. The thieves are the victims of their own folly, as well as the stolen front. But what the government understands, Mrs. Shuley, S-H-U-E-Y, if you would go with this lady, she has an important message for you. The important thing of a republic is a government, a form of government, in which the government is restricted to doing for the citizen only those things that the citizen had a right to do for himself, individually. That is, to protect the citizen's lives, liberty, and property from all who would endanger him, both internally and externally, either by intent or neglect. I can't drive 90 miles an hour down the street in front of this hotel because by my negligent act, I'm endangering the lives and properties of others. The government, therefore, has a just right to prohibit me from taking those actions. But if driving 90 miles an hour down the street had no possibility of injuring another's life or property, then the government has no power, a just government, to interfere with it. That's why they can drive 150 miles an hour at Indianapolis, and you're not supposed to do it on the street out front of this hotel. When a government is defending the lives and properties of its citizens from all who would endanger them by intent or neglect, either domestic or foreign, then that government is legitimate and its actions are just. When it goes beyond that and does for a citizen what we would not let a citizen do for himself, the government is criminal. A republic is a government restricted to just acts only and prohibited from entering in the areas of expropriation of property of its citizens. A democracy is a form of government that the very form of government, its whole existence, is for the expropriation of the earnings of another. And this has been true in the whole history of mankind, and is true in the very nature. There cannot be a good democracy. Why, until the First World War, the word democracy was never applied to the United States? It was a republic for which we stand. Remember? Read the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States, and you will not find the word democracy contained therein. In fact, the very form of government our Constitution was written to prevent was democracy. It was the one form of government our founding fathers feared most. And the problems that they debated and argued over in drafting that Constitution was how to prevent your republic from degenerating into a democracy. How to prevent the government from robbing its citizens. How to prevent the do-gooders with their overworked waterworks going around and demanding that the government steal for the good of the people. You see, and this is the whole problem we've had. Let's take a look at some economics right now, very quickly. Let's take the word capital. We are told that there's some gigantic war in the world today between something called communism and capitalism. But notice that all of our great digesters of all information, that is, our experts, Bluntly and Pinkley and the rest of the crew, who tell us what to think about everything that happens, because you're too dumb to think about it yourself, and so they're going to digest all your news. You notice we get a new thing in a newspaper today. In the old days, you used to have on the front page or on the news page, news. It told you what happened. Editorials are on the editorial pages, the opinions of the newspapers. Now you get a melange, which is called interpretive reporting, which means, you dummy, you don't know what to think, so we're going to tell you right now what to think about everything we're going to tell you about what happened. And some of the things you don't aren't really good for you to know, so we're not going to tell you about them at all. And now that we've digested your everything for you, we don't need to put in the facts anymore.
And you'll find in most news articles less than one sentence for every 40 sentences that contain news. The rest contains the opinions of the jerk who wrote the article. Now, I don't mind his jerky opinions as long as he puts them on the editorial page. In honest reporting. And keeps them off the news page. Just give me the stuff. I can make it up for myself, as somebody once said. I don't need you to do the job. You notice with all of this battle between communism and capitalism, they don't define the terms? Why don't they define the terms? You look, when two kids are out arguing, and one's saying, well, look, if you did this, this, and that, and the other one's calling the other guy a bunch of names. Stupid, the whole thing. What's the purpose of this? The one guy's right. He's trying to argue about the issues. The other guy is trying to shut the whole debate off, isn't he? The guy name caller. Notice, the people who are calling names and don't want to discuss issues. Notice attack on the Birch Society. The total attack is their name calling. Nazi, fascist, racist, every name you can think of. But never to talk about the issues. Never talking about republic, democracy, communism, capitalism. Never talking about issues. Total name calling. Well, anybody knows this. They've been out in the street when 5 years old. Knows what the answer to that one is. The one wants to silence the other because the other one's telling you the truth. You don't want it to come out, right? That's an obvious thing. Any 5-year-old would understand it, but after 20 years of education, we get all mixed up. Attention. You couldn't sell this stuff to 5-year-olds. They wouldn't buy it. Let's define the word capitalism. By the way, until lunch, all I'm doing is making definitions, if you notice. Because until we get a language, a common language, we can't even start discussing what I came here to talk about. I haven't even got to it yet. This is all introduction. I hope you know that. What is capitalism? In economics, there are only two kinds of goods in the world. All goods, all material things, fall into two groups. Economic goods and non-economic goods. You can't beat that one for a definition. How do you tell the difference? You got to pay for the economic goods. If there's a price on it, it's economic. If there's not a price on it, it's non-economic. How's that for clarity? That's the first 2 years of economics. Now we go on to the third year. In the third year, you'll learn this great truth. By the way, in the average college course, you see, you get less than about 20 minutes of real material for 15 weeks. Honestly, you learn to look at the major university and you split the courses down and down and down so everybody can be an expert in a subject so small nobody else would ever muscle in on. And every faculty member wants to be a muscle, an expert, so if you've got 2,000 faculty members, you've got to break up what you're teaching into 2,000 little separate segments, all of which are so small that they don't constitute more than 20 minutes worth of honest material. Those of you who have been in college in the last 20 years know that's true. The average college course could be told in 20 minutes what it contained. Of any value. Or even not value. In fact, it's a good course that you can get that much out of. It does keep them off the streets for a while. No, it doesn't. Now they got signs. They used to just be out there, you know, mugging a few people on their own in private enterprise. Now they're marching in ranks. Well, they go out and threaten the people with violence and mayhem. Because they've been educated. Now they know how to be filthier. You can't get that naturally. Even a cat cleans itself. We'll get more to that subject later. But let's go back to the thing capital. All economic goods fall into two categories. They're either consumption goods or capital goods. A consumption good is any good that directly satisfies the human want and has a price on it. A capital good is any good that does not directly satisfy the human want, but will produce one that will satisfy a human want. For notice, if the good won't satisfy a human want and won't produce one that will satisfy a human want, human beings won't put a price on it. Includes all goods, you see. Now, let's take a look at what capital really is. I have an aborigine, see, and he's out chasing bunny rabbits with his bare hands. Through the bush. He catches a bunny rabbit, and he eats a bunny rabbit, and he throws the bones over his shoulders. Now, that bunny rabbit is a capital good.
I'm a consumption good. Excuse me, my definition. That's a consumption good. He consumed it. That's how we know it. It's a consumption good. Now, he sits there and he says to himself, you know, I don't get very many bunny rabbits chasing me through the woods with my bare hands, see? I'm going to make me a blowgun, and I'm going to get me more bunny rabbits. After about 6 weeks of debate, design, engineering, he finally sits down and he starts making himself a blowgun. And he gets his blowgun done. Now, notice something about the blowgun. One, it doesn't satisfy any human want. He doesn't want to wear the blowgun. He can't eat the blowgun. He doesn't want to sleep in the blowgun. He doesn't live in the blowgun. The blowgun itself has no value. What did it cost him to get the blowgun? The bunny rabbits he didn't get while he was making the blowgun. His investment was the lack of bunny rabbits. Now, that's very sound economics. Now, that's his investment. What is the value of the blowgun? Has nothing to do with what he paid for it, is it? The value of the blowgun is how many bunny rabbits it's going to get. Notice that the blowgun won't get any more bunny rabbits than he got with his bare hands. He throws the blowgun over his shoulder and forgets the whole thing and goes back to chasing bunny rabbits or thinking of a new way of getting bunny rabbits. The blowgun's value is in its future production of bunny rabbits in excess of the bunny rabbits he would have got if he didn't have a blowgun. And notice that future production is not greater than the bunny rabbits he would have got without the blowgun. The blowgun has no value, regardless of how beautiful the blowgun and no matter how much he worked to make it. The value of the blowgun is not in the blowgun, it's in what it will produce. A capital goods value is not in itself, it's in its productive capacity. There's 6 years of economics right there in a package. Now we can go to the graduate level. Once we have these definitions. Now, every society in the world, from the most primitive society, is capitalistic. And every society wants to become more so. No communist has ever tried to do away with capital. In fact, they're trying to get more of it, aren't they? They're not against capital. They're against who owns the capital. Let me give you an illustration here. You buy a car. You pay the payments, taxes, the insurance. You pay all the gas and oil. You pay all the repairs. You pay for everything in that car, but you never get to drive it. You don't even get to see it. I drive it every day. Who's better off, me or you? Well, you are. You're rich. You own a car. I'm poor. I don't own a car. Isn't that right? My point is, it isn't important who owns. It's who controls. Notice, our super rich give away their money, title only, but not control. They have total control as if it's in their total personal bank account, but they gave away title, so they don't pay any taxes. Last year, people in the United States earning $20 million or more paid less than 7% income taxes. People in the United States earning $600,000 or more, this is by the Internal Revenue Code figure, who earn $600,000 or more paid less, or half of them, excuse me, didn't pay any taxes at all. Where 85% of the entire income tax taken in the United States last year came from the lowest bracket taxpayer. I like those apples. Huh? Somebody's been taken again, haven't they? Yeah, you're supposed to think you're taken away from the rich, aren't you? Oh, no. That's what they tell you. Who owns the newspapers telling you this? We'll forget that one. Let's not pursue that anymore. My point, getting back to capital. The communists are not against capital, isn't it? They're against individual ownership of capitalism. Let's get that clear. They're not for doing away with capital. They're doing away with your right to own it. They're after the destruction of private property. Notice, what is the basic right? I see students with the sign that says, human rights above property rights. Tears. I want to tell you something. The fundamental human right is the right to private property. Without the right to private property, you're a slave. Every slave does not have the right to private property. The massa has his property. The massa owns it. Somebody owns it.
The slave doesn't. A man can either possess what he has created, that means he's free, or he can't possess it. He's a slave. The difference between a slave and a free man is private property. The masses don't like private property. They don't want the slaves to have private property. A free man must have private property to be free. If you cannot acquire, hold, enjoy, and dispose of your earnings as you see fit, you are the slave of whoever can. Make no mistake about it. The communists are attacking private property, for they are attacking the liberty of the individual to run and govern his own life and actions. If you are talking about being free and talking about having private property abridged, you're mixed up. You can't have it any more than you can have dry water or civil rights. They're impossibilities. But you're not supposed to think that far. Remember, it's going to be given to you by bluntly and pinkly. And they're going to tell you how to interpret all these sort of things because you're too dumb to figure those things out. Okay, all economic systems are capitalistic. The question isn't whether there is or is not capital. The question is who owns the capital. That's the key. Who owns and controls the capital? Let's take a look at competitive capitalism. I usually have something up here. Hold up. Well, I have to hold this up. I produce this product, see? Well, let me give you another example. I have a Nigerian Negro female, aged 5, is over here visiting her aunt. And her aunt says, Martha, you go down and pick a quart of berries down the berry patch, and I'll give you a quarter. Martha grabs a little bucket. She goes down, she picks the berries. Her aunt gives her a quarter. And Martha's going down to the voting booth. She goes down to the voting booth, going to the candy store, and she decides she's going to vote. Now, notice the election man in there doesn't say, Martha, you're not an American citizen. Martha, you're of a minority race. Martha, you're not of age. Martha, you're a female. You can't vote. Oh, no. He says, how many votes you got, Martha? Martha says, I got 25 votes. He says, go ahead and vote. Nobody asks anything about Martha. He says, how many votes she got? I got 25 votes. No, she can vote anytime she works. She can vote. She can vote how much she works. Not one man, one vote. How much you work, how much you produce gives you that much right to vote. So she walks down. She says, I'm going to vote 5 votes for that company to succeed. I want that company to go out of business. I hate that company. I want 4 votes for that company. She spends an hour voting, like most women. If you're waiting in a line, that insulted at least half the audience. Okay. I have to get everybody in there. So she's doing the voting. Now notice, the candy company voted for had to win the election against all of the candy companies, didn't it? And all ice cream, and soda pop, and popcorn. Also, against saving, or movie houses, or anything else Martha might have wanted to use a quarter for. Also, even against the beach. Martha could have said to Annie, I don't want to pick berries. I'm going to go swimming. That candy company had to beat out everybody in the world in that election. Notice something else about this election. It's every day. You don't have to wait every 4 years. Second, everybody gets what they vote for. Right or wrong, you get what you vote for. Also, the election's always honest. The guy can't stuff the ballot box. You can't go out and buy your own product back to voter order to boost the votes. You can't beat the election. It is totally honest. It's every day. Everybody votes according to their work. Some people don't like that kind of election. Those people who don't like the work. They think it's unfair. They want to vote anyway. And they want what they call their share without producing. Everything in this world is consumed, is produced. You can't consume what isn't produced. Either you produce it or you must take it away from the man who did. Any person who says, I want my share and I demand my share, and he isn't earning his share, is a thief. But there's no other way around it. Now, this election is what we call competitive capitalism. Look, I produce this item. and I get a 10% markup on it. Why? If I only get 9%, I'm going to the beach. I'm not going to waste my time worrying about producing and running my company all the grief and trouble if I only get 9%. 10% is what takes me to stay in this business. I won't stay for less. But you see this guy here? He's not a very nice guy, you see. I know this. If I charge only 10% more, it doesn't cost you much, just 10% more, I make 100% more profit, don't I? Now, isn't that the way we all get rich? That's what Keynes tells us. You know, after all, it only costs you 10% more. I get 100% more. That means a 90% increase in production, doesn't it? You got to get this sort of thinking. You know, unless you really get this stuff, you're never going to get a doctor's degree in economics. You won't make it. I can just tell you, people are not going to make it. But you see, why don't I raise my price to 10%? Because this guy's a dishonest, dirty, rotten man. You know what that guy would do? He's so grubby and dirty, he'd produce my product and sell it for 19% profit. Because the business he's in, he says, look, I only get 10%, Crane's getting 20, I'm going to go produce his, and I'll undersell him. So I get even with the guy. I go 18, he goes 17, 16, 15, 14, we're both back down to 10. We got to end up there. Now notice, he gets smart. He figures out a better way to produce the product. He saves 2% of our society's resources. And so he undercuts me by 2%. I can't meet him, can I? I'm forced out of business and release those resources to him because he's more efficient. Only the most efficient can survive. It's a ruthless, dog-eat-dog, dirty, rough way to run business. Except one thing it does. It produces the most product and creates the most progress and the most prosperity possible. And the person who gets all the breaks is the consumer. The producer gets no breaks. You can see why some producers don't like the system. The system is not free enterprise, it's enslaved enterprise. That guy down the street who knocks your prices and undercuts you every time you try to raise them doesn't leave you very free, does he? Competition is a very ruthless way of running a system. All it does is produce the greatest prosperity and liberty possible. But it doesn't create big profits. Now, let us say I decide I'd like to make a 20% profit. How can I do it? Well, I could shoot this guy. But the trouble is, this guy is as dirty as he is. And he starts producing, so I shoot him, and I shoot him, and I have to shoot him, and I have to shoot everybody in this room, because all of you people are just as dirty as this guy. Now, the problem is, if I try to use this method of keeping others from out of my market, because I cannot get my price up unless I can keep others from selling in my market. The only way I can get an unfair price is by restricting other people from selling in my market. If I can't do this, I cannot be a monopolist. A monopolist must be able to restrict entry into his market. Now, shooting all possible competitors is not very good because I have to shoot everyone and I have no customers. It doesn't work. So I have to use another method. There is only one other method of creating a monopoly. I get the government to pass a law against unfair competition. I get the government to pass a law for a franchise for me, or a license that says only I can sell in this market and nobody else can. Or I get a subsidy to reduce my costs below yours and tax you to pay me and raise your costs over mine. Or I get a parity. Or I get myself a patent says you can't produce it even. Or I get a tariff, particularly if you're outside of this area, making you pay a special tax to sell to give you a cost disadvantage in my market, so you cannot sell in the market. Or I have to somehow, in one way or the other, to get a government to restrict the market. Only government can restrict markets. Only government can create monopoly. No businessman can. Governments never do away with monopoly. They're the instrument of the creation. No monopoly can exist without some action on the part of government to create it. I'll give you a little example. In the city of Detroit, every boiler has to have a special little round ball called a McDonald boiler fill. It's a little cast iron ball with a little float in it and a little electric switch. That if the water drops, it shuts, you know, a 10-cent switch over there and it's a little ball. Now, everyone has to have it by law, and only one brand is approved by the city government. The little ball costs $247. You have another little one. Guy's got two parts. I got a lot, and you got a lot near the ballpark. Now, I get a dollar a car on my lot. You can't get any. You see, it would only be 25 cents if we both were having cars on a lot, and that would be unfair competition, wouldn't it? Because a customer would get a break. We can't have that. I got a little tin plate up there that says, I can park cars, and you don't have a tin plate. You can't. And there's a guy in a blue uniform that comes around and enforces the protection racket, doesn't it? And down in Detroit a while back in the recorder's court, and here is the judge, and he says, "Use guys." That's the way our judges talk, you see. "We're not going to let you muscle in on Detroit any longer. See, these are cabbies who drop fares inside the city of Detroit. Now, the boys in this city," that's the cabbies, in the city, "have paid for protection." He doesn't use those words quite like that. He says they've got a licensing. "And we're not going to let Jewish guys come in here and muscle in on their business." That is, you aren't going to have any competition to give the customer a break. "To all of you for the first offenders, we'll have a $200 automatic fine, $500 for the second offense, and $1,000 for the third offense." Dropping a fine fare inside the city of Detroit across the city lines. And they marshal across. A whole room full. As they extract. His job is to enforce the monopoly control. Only government can do so. And if you can take this from the little local monopoly, you got to have influence downtown, to a statewide monopoly, you better have in Sacramento, to the national monopoly, therefore you got to have a federal government with enough power to restrict trade and commerce within the whole United States to be able to give you a special advantage in the market. And if you're going to be an international monopolist, you need a United Nations to control world markets. It's inefficient to try to control 120 governments. It's much better if you can put them all in one. You only have to buy less men that way. Notice the United Nations is not even democratic. Nobody's even elected. Now notice something. When we turn all the arms of the world over to the United Nations, it will be a peacekeeping organization. It will keep peace. Peace is in a slave labor camp. Peace is in prison. There will be peace. For as our government says, our policy is to turn over sufficient arms and ammunition to the United Nations so that no one dares resist. That's our foreign policy. Why, you see, the guards there at San Quentin have sufficient guns so no one dares resist. That's peace, isn't it? And that's peaceful. The NKVD has enough guns and ammunition in Russia to make sure that no one dares resist. That creates peace, doesn't it? And you want to have a world peacekeeping force? Sure, all you need is a world Gestapo. And that's what the United Nations is. It's going to keep peace. For if you do not obey the edicts of that clique, and if they aren't able to control the total wealth and the total lives of everybody without objection, they are to have sufficient force to see that you become peaceful. And they intend to be a peacekeeping organization. They mean it. You just have to know what they mean by the word peace. They intend to have you obedient and peaceful. Or obedient or peaceful. It depends. They have a ways of accomplishing peace. Like kapow. Right? That's instant peace. In China they call it seomei. The night of existence. They've already sailmade over 80 million human beings. In China, if you ever owned a half acre of land, the punishment is to have your arms and your hands and feet chopped off. If you live, you now must live on your hands and knees, or as a dog. You can't pick up food. You can't work. You must live on handouts like a dog and eat out of a plate off the ground. These are the kind of people we're dealing with. Capable of any torture and any evil. Some people don't believe that people can be totally depraved, but some get awful close. All you have to deny is all morality. There you are. You're right. Anyway, monopoly, the means of production may be owned privately. But the prices are set by the producers, not the consumers. The consumers don't decide the prices. The producers do. And the only way the producers can decide the prices is by controlling the government of the market in which they want to have their monopoly in.
They must have sufficient control. Therefore, a producer has to see that government has the power to expropriate from one citizen and give to another. That's not possible in a republic. So a monopolist must be committed to the destruction of the republic. In a republic, the government doesn't have the power to give the advantage of one producer over another. And if you want an advantage of one producer over another, you must destroy first the republic. You want to find out why they're pushing democracy? So that all you have to do is calm the mob and rob them. And notice, it's the people who vote for it are the ones who get robbed. They're not considered very bright anyway. Let's take a look at fascism. Again, let's go to our definitions. We are told by just shouting at the word fascist, 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 that fascism is something kind of anti-communist. It's a fascist, isn't it? Is this what the inference, notice I said inference, given in our media, in our schools, is that a fascist is an anti-communist? They don't come out and really say this too much. It's all done by implication. As Lenin said, always attach unpopular names to your opposition. But more important was this. He said, always accuse your enemy of what you are. I'll repeat that. Always accuse your enemy of what you are. This confuses everybody. And most people just retire from the battle. And it gives them a clear, right, because nobody wants to be a fascist and seeing they don't know which side is fascist, you just get out of the whole thing. Let's take some literal definitions. The word fascist means a bundle of sticks. That's what the word means, a bundle of sticks. Nothing more. That's a fascist. So an Italian word. Now, you notice Benito Mussolini had as an emblem a bundle of sticks. The emperors of Rome had as an emblem the bundle of sticks. On the back of our Liberty Head dime, we had a bundle of sticks. And by the way, that's been changed to a torch of illumination, if you notice. But that's an inside one. Those of you who didn't catch that, you'll get it later. That's just a little advanced look. What do we mean by fascist? Remember the fable about the father who gave to the sons each a stick and they could break it easily, but he gave them the bundle and they couldn't break it. The idea that through unity there is strength. Have we heard that one before? Now notice, what did Benito Mussolini say? He says, I don't believe in a socialism. You see, the Catholic Church was against government ownership of property, and so he decided there were some Catholics in Italy. He'd skip this question. But he says, Italy is weak, and Italy is poor. Italy is weak and poor because everybody's going their own way, and we're not working together for the good of Italy. If Italy was strong and rich, Italians would be strong and rich. What is good for Italy is good for Italians. Now, I don't believe in the socialism. I don't believe the government should own a property. But some of you people don't produce the right of goods, in the right of quantity, pay the right of wages, the right of prices. So I, Benito, will tell you what the prices and the wages will be and what you'll produce and how much. Outside of that, free enterprise. Now, once we had this free enterprise system, notice no means of production were owned by the state, but all was controlled by the state. Remember my automobile? Here we have the perfect example. What does fascism really mean? It means this, that the community is more important than the individual. That the good of the community, the good for society, the good of humanity is more important than the individual, the good of the state. And therefore, when there is conflict between the interest of the individual and the interest of society, the individual must yield for the good of society. That is the motto of fascism. What does the communist say? The group, the community, society comes ahead of the individual. The individual rights must be subservient for the good of the society, for the group, for the state. What communism is perfect fascism. Fascism carried to its ultimate form. So what do the communists shout at their opposition? Fascist, fascist. Why? They don't want you to understand they're the fascists. It is the most fascist system of all. And the best way to hide it is to accuse your enemies of being it, as Lenin said. What does the John Birch Society, for example, say? We don't want the power, nor anyone else to have the power. That the individual must be supreme. What did our Constitution say? Was it to protect society from the individual? That's what the communist state is for. That's what the fascist state is. Society, the state, must be protected from the individual. Our Constitution says we protect the life, liberty, and property of each single citizen, that the government is created for protecting the individual from the majority, from the mob, from the community, to protect his right to worship as he pleases, regardless of what others think, the right to live and to run and conduct his own life as he sees fit and not comply to the will of the majority or to the mob. Freedom is the denial of the will of the mob, of the majority, or of society, and the government protects only one thing, the liberty of the single person. The single individual are from society and looks upon society as the enemy of individual liberty and individual liberty as the goal to protect. And if every single citizen's life, liberty, and property is protected, we don't have to worry about society. You already have the best possible society. That is what the concept of the Constitution, but the monopolists don't like that concept. It doesn't make for fat profits. So this is what fascism is. Let's take a look at Nazism. National Socialist Deutsches Arbeiter Party. National Socialist German Workers Party. Notice Lyndon Johnson said he was an American. He said he was for taking away from those who had too much and giving to those who had too little. He never took any of his own away, it seemed like. Anyway, he said he headed the Workers' Party. National Socialist America Arbeiter Party. And let's look at the program. But Adolf Hitler says, who are you trying to kid, Benito? What's all this white hat business? There's no reason I can't own a few businesses, too. See, I'm going to control all wages, prices, what's produced, and how much. What's the difference whether we have a privately owned group I control or a governmentally owned Volkswagen, which I own? What's all this? He had less Catholics, you see. And so we had basically the same society, except for the government ownership of some of the industry, direct ownership, which was not true in fascist Italy. Was Nazi Germany fascist? Certainly. The state came first, didn't it? The will of the group, the will of the majority. And notice, through unity there is strength. What was the motto of Adolf Hitler? Ein Reich, ein Führer, ein Führer. One nation, one people, one leader. Adolf, see? All for your own good, of course. Gave you law and order, didn't I? Gave you peace. Anyone who wasn't peaceful, like Gestapo, made it very peaceful. Didn't you get lots of peace? Sure did. And we had, for those people who weren't peaceful enough, we had special peace camps. And we had peace ovens, which made for lots of peace. Oh, yes. And remember, everybody's for peace. I'm sure you get lots of it. Let's look at, let's look at our own government. The United States government directly owns outright over 700 private industries and businesses, making it the largest private cartel in the world. Ansco Film is a totally owned government company, for example. And holds... Ansco Film, yes. They, in the private sector, are the largest cartel in the world. We are following Adolf. You see, the only thing they haven't got yet is total price and wage controls. But notice the balloons? Mr. Welch has been telling me for years, they're pushing the inflation is going to be... I have a doctor's degree in economics, and I don't want to throw that around as an authority at all, because I look upon that as only a statement that I know all the things that aren't true. But there's one thing I did learn. Only one, they didn't tell me this, but I did learn it. You see, you sometimes you think a little bit on your own, just try it a few minutes, it isn't really that hard. There's only one institution that can create inflation. There never has been a wage price spiral, and there can't be one. See, all the strikers in the world can strike all they want. They can't get a wage increase unless the company can pay it. And the company can't pay it unless they can get it away from the customers. And the customers can't pay it unless there's an increase in the money supply. And the money supply is increased by government. How is it increased by government? By deficit spending. Deficit spending increases the purchasing power in the hands of the public without taking it away in the form of taxation, leaving a net surplus of purchasing power without an increase in goods and services. With increased purchasing power, without an increase in goods and services, the price of existing goods and services must rise to meet the purchasing power. The inflation is not only happens, it's instantaneous. It is a direct and instantaneous result of deficit spending. Only government can create it. But government doesn't say, therefore we're going to balance our budget to fight inflation. No. They're going to need wage and price controls to control wage earners and competition. To control them. When you control a man's wages and earnings, you control his family and his actions, and he becomes your vassal. The key to total control, dictatorial control, is wage and price controls. And you see the balloons all up? Inflation is terrible. And you notice, they tell us for years, that our government monetary system and our financial policy, our fiscal policy, is to run surpluses in good years and deficits in bad years to even out the purchasing power to stop the cyclical movement of our economy. But during the prosperous years, we run bigger deficits than ever. When do we have those surplus years? We don't. Today, the United States government owes in debt over $1 trillion. Over 1,000 thousands of millions. Or over a million millions. Well, you say, oh, the federal debt isn't that big. But you're only looking at the general fund. Let's take all the government corporations and activities and take their total bonded indebtedness, and it exceeds 70% of the market value of all land and property, real property, in the United States. That's a lot of money. But the interesting thing is this. Somebody earns 60 thousands of millions a year interest. Taken by force from the American taxpayers, for which these people gave nothing. They created debt by an ink entry on two sides of a piece of paper. And for that ink entry, they extract legally, by the Internal Revenue process, 60,000 millions of Americans' earnings annually. But you couldn't extract that without big debt, could you? Legally, you'd have to use the old machine gun technique. Now you have your collection guys, the IRS, do it in nice suits and shirts and ties. And you go down and cower, wondering how much you're going to steal this time, and I hope you don't steal too much more than I got. And you're supposed to go in there and cringe before the thief who stands there in regal splendor and demands that you come in and turn over voluntarily the loot. Well, part of the game. Pretty sharp, you got to admit. Brilliant. Brilliant. And all for the poor. Remember that. It's all for the downtrodden. Oh, we'll look at the downtrodden later. They're really lovely. The wonderful people who have helped out our downtrodden. It gets me right. No, it's on this side. Right there. Anyway, Nazi Germany, totally fascist. State comes first. The Reich comes first. And you pay. So everything is controlled by the state. Let's take a look. We got 5 minutes to lunchtime. I'm getting a real quick thing of it. Let's take a look at socialism. British Fabian socialism. The means of production, only the major means of production are taken by the state. You control all finance, all utilities, all communication, all transportation, all raw materials, and all heavy industry. And you control every businessman. All you have to do is manipulate your prices, your monopoly prices, and you can extract anything he earns. You don't have to go down and run his shop. See, he's got to buy from you his basic services. You set up the monopoly now only on the major means of production, and through price fixing, you can rob anyone you wish. And he has no choice to go anywhere else.